Hey, what's going on, everybody? My name's Jacob Cozy Pat, and welcome to the pilot episode of my podcast, Keepin' Cozy. Like many young professionals, I'm still finding my answer to that old question, what do you want to do when you get older? I've spent some time talking with many different established professionals about how they figured out their answers to that very question. Now, as I go along my personal career journey, I want to share that advice with you. To help keep you calm, and achieve greater clarity in an uncertain career world. This is Keepin' Cozy. Our first guest is John LaMattina, one of the most respected members of the pharmaceutical industry. He's a former president of research and development at Pfizer, where he worked for over 30 years, and is presently a partner at PureTech Pharmaceuticals. Outside of work, he's the author of two books, Drug Truths, Dispelling the Myths of Research and Development, and Devalued and Distrusted, Can the Pharmaceutical Industry Restore Its Broken Image? He's appeared on the Dr. Oz Show, written for Forbes magazine, and was on the Board of Trustees of Boston College, his alma mater. For those who don't know, Pfizer is one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. They're responsible for the production, creation, and distribution of drugs like Lipitor and Viagra. Today, we're going to talk to him about COVID-19 and for personal advice on entering the pharmaceutical world. John, could you walk us through the basic journey of creating a vaccine from like hypothesis to distribution?
So the challenge of making a vaccine is coming up with the appropriate therapeutic modality that you can introduce into the body, into cells, and have the body's immune system rev up and develop the antibodies and other parts of the immune system to fight off the infection, in this case, a virus. It is not an intellectually extremely complex exercise because people know how to do it. People know how to isolate the potential mediators that you can use here. The challenge is basically finding the appropriate one or ones, in this case, multiple candidates, that you then can develop a way of introducing them to the body. And then having the body then react to it. So the real factor, and I'm not trying to minimize the intellectual expertise that goes into vaccine making. I'm just saying that it's understood how to do it, and the matter is finding the right things to use, and then be able to develop them safely and efficaciously. Now the reason it takes so much time, although to be honest, some of the timelines being put out are remarkably quick, as I'll mention in a second, but the challenge then is to make sure it's effective and safe. And so you do some animal model testing initially, and then some early stage testing in people, and you just don't take one or two people and say it's safe and then give it to millions, and in this case maybe a billion people around the world. You've really got to show that the material is first, that it works, second, that it's safe, and then third, that it's durable. So you don't want to develop a vaccine that only lasts for a month or two. You want to make sure that's going to last for at least a year, so that if you have to revaccinate patients every year, at least it's once a year, and it's somewhat practical to do, like you do with a flu vaccine every year. So the fundamentals are there. People are a number of companies have gone in and working pretty hard on this now, and the president of CEO of Johnson & Johnson has come out and said he thinks he can have one by the first quarter of next year, if all things go right. And they're working closely with the FDA to make that happen. That is actually a remarkably fast timeline for anything like this to occur. So I applaud them for developing all the resources they can and to try and make this happen.
Yeah, just kind of on that note, do you think the speed at which these companies are trying to get a vaccine will pose greater threats kind of down the line?
I don't think so. At least I hope not, because eventually they're all working with the FDA, and the FDA will have certain high bars and standards that you have to show that your vaccine is safe. And so that's why it's going to take time. I mean, the actual vaccine testing, I've heard, might start within the next month or so.
I see.
But you're really going to expose a lot of people to it just to make sure that it's safe and it's working. And then it's durable. So that's what really takes the time.
I see.
But no, they won't cut corners for this because if you're going to expose hundreds of millions of people to this, you want to make sure it's safe and you don't cause any other problems.
I see. Now, do you think companies like Gilead and Merck and Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer could collaborate?
So a couple of things. Companies are doing different things, and we can get into that in a second if you like. Some of the people who are vaccine experts are working on vaccine, but and two companies actually are working together. GSK and AstraZeneca are working together to pool their capabilities to bring something forward. You know, different companies that make vaccines have their own ways, their own platforms of delivering vaccines, and so their differences at a time like this could be a strength because they're all working on it. There's no guarantee that one company's way of doing it will be better than another. And so by having multiple companies go for it is pretty much a guarantee that somebody will succeed sooner rather than later. So I think that's an important thing to do. Gilead and there are other companies developing therapeutics. So there are two ways to attack this. One way is with a vaccine, which is the ultimate gold standard, what you want to do. Basically, you want to prevent people from getting the disease. But until you have a vaccine, people are going to get it. And so there are companies looking for therapeutins that you can give to somebody who's already gotten a virus, and the drug that they would administer would kill the virus itself. So that's not ideal in that a vaccine, you don't even get it. But if you get the COVID-19, if you have a therapeutin, you can at least minimize the amount of damage it does to your body and hopefully minimize the amount of time you'd spend in a hospital.
I see.
Or have complications.
I do want to run with that topic. Could you say that again? Therapeutic?
Therapeutics, that's right. So a vaccine is one way of doing it. A therapeutic is a drug. A drug that you give that's an antiviral that will fight the virus once it's already been in your body.
I see. So I guess one of the ones that has been in the news for a bit has been hydroxychloroquine. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. And this, unfortunately, has become a political topic as well. So I'll try and steer clear of that. Basically, it was found that hydroxychloroquine combined with Zithromax, which is a drug combination used to treat malaria, might be of value in having antiviral properties or preventing more importantly, preventing the inflammatory response to the virus. And so there was a study done in France by a doctor, a lot of people have questioned the validity of the study, but nevertheless, the study had some promise, and this combination is being studied all sorts of places now throughout in a number of trials around the world. President Trump focused on it, and he felt it might be useful. And he said, well, it's safe in malaria, so how bad can it be? But it turns out that that combination does have adverse effects in people in terms of interfering with regular heartbeats and can cause sudden death. And so, and like any drug that you take, there's going to be benefit and risk. So hydroxychloroquine right now is in trials. We'll see what happens. But it's early days to find out if it's really working. You know, to run a real trial, what you have to do is have a number of patients. I'll just make up a number, 200 patients. And half of them you give the drug and half of them you give the placebo. And then you measure and see who recovers. And hopefully the people on the drug are recovering and show that it's doing better than a placebo would be. Because when you give a drug to somebody with the virus, it could be that their own immune system is already fighting it. And so they may recover. And you say, oh, the drug did it. And in fact, they would have recovered on their own without the drug. So if it depends on if you give people the drug and when they have the disease in early stage or a moderate stage or a late stage, and trying to understand it, it's how it works. And then you also have to make sure that people aren't dying of sudden heart attack. So a number of these drugs have looked somewhat positive up to this point in some very early stages, just giving to people who were dying as a last resort, and they saw some effects. So now they're going back and trying to see if the effects are real and that they weren't just caused because the body was the natural body defenses were actually what worked and caused the disease to decline.
I see. Well, I guess kind of on the topic of coming up with a cure or something to aid the COVID-19, Dr. Fauci has said that he foresees a future without ever shaking hands again. What do you think about that statement?
It's a very interesting statement. You know what this, first of all, your audience, as I assume some of which who have had a Jesuit education, much like myself, Dr. Fauci's from Brooklyn. He went to a Jesuit high school in Brooklyn, Regis, but then he went to Holy Cross. So, but we'll forgive him for that. But nevertheless, I think what he's really raising here is the point of any flu or virus that's contagious can be spread by a hand-to-hand contact. And in this case, the virus gets on your hand and you touch your face and you can get it. And so his view is, you know, in times of, and every year there's a bad flu season, particularly as you get older in life, you become more vulnerable to it. So even though I get a flu shot every year, the flu shot will only work, maybe 60% of the time. It's not infallible. And so you want to try and minimize the spread of flu at that time of year. And to be honest, I wouldn't mind when you just do what the, I think Japanese, instead of shaking hands, will bow, maybe doing something like that. But I think what Fauci's real purpose in his message is basically talking about contact and talking about flu. A few years ago, there was a bad flu pandemic at church, at the handshake of peace. People did fist bumps or just nodded at each other. And I think that's, to be honest, a better practice to have going forward. So, it could become very real. I think your broader question was, how is life going to change? Until a vaccine, I have to tell you, I'm 70 years old now. I'm not getting on any planes. And I am a season ticket holder to a number of, including Boston College football. I don't see myself going to football, even though I already have my tickets. I don't see myself going to games at the Heights this year simply for fear of catching the virus. So certainly in the short term, until the vaccine's available, I think it's going to have an effect on people. I'm a big movie buff. I don't see myself going to theaters. I might go to a restaurant as states reopen if there's social distancing in the restaurant, but even then I'll think twice a little bit. So it's going to, until we're really clear of this, I think it's going to have a real effect on people around the world.
Yeah. So do you think that these like promises or ideas of getting the economy back to where it was at, do you think that's a bit ambitious or where do you
see 2020? You have to offer people hope and you have to give people a sense of when is this going to be over? So how best you do that? I think even though you might be able to open states and based on the president's remarks last night, he's encouraging some states with hardly any coronavirus incidents. Of opening, and that's all well and good. But the real hit has been the service industry, and now 22 million people in 3 weeks, have filed for unemployment insurance. It's going to take a while for the service industry to come back. So I just told you, I tend to go out to dinner a lot. I tend to go to 50 movies a year. I go to 40 sporting events every year. I'm not doing any of that until I can get a vaccine to this. And I'm not going to be alone. Lots of people are going to hold off going back. And so most of the people who are unemployed, I think, are in service industries. And it's going to be a while for all that to come back. So this is good. This is not going to be what's called a V-shaped experience that, you lose all these jobs, but then it's going to come right back as rapidly. Some jobs will, but not all of them will. And it will be maybe 24 months, I think, at least.
I see.
To really getting back to normal behaviors, assuming vaccines are in place and everybody can get vaccinated and move forward from there.
Yeah, I guess kind of on that tone, what would it look like when they actually get a vaccine? Would people be able to get that? Or is that something that you...
Oh, well, I assume so. Every company that's working on a vaccine is also, and this is wonderful what these companies are doing. Not only are they gearing up to make a vaccine, but they're already building production facilities to make it on the scale that has to be made. You're talking about, I don't know, there are 6 billion people in the world, at least around the world, at least a billion would have to get vaccinated at some point. So you're talking about a lot of vaccines and people are gearing up. You're much too young to know this, but when I was in graduate school, there was a what was called a worry about a swine flu epidemic. And I remember going to a gymnasium in the town I was living in at the time, lining up and getting vaccinated for swine flu. I can see the same sort of thing happening now, where all these places that are set up now for testing will be used for people to get massive inoculations. So I can see that happening. And it's great that these companies are taking the risk, because there's no guarantee their vaccines are going to work, but they're taking the hundreds of millions of dollars in investment in building facilities to be able to mass produce these vaccines. So they deserve a lot of credit.
I see. Yeah, no, it's interesting that they're already preparing to build the facilities for dealing with the problem. But kind of on that tone, going back to like the corporate side / working with the companies, what does the behind of the scenes kind of look like on the research and development side and in the boardroom when like a new disease like or drug or virus like SARS or Ebola or swine flu or right now coronavirus, like what is the news headline?
So I guess in my Pfizer experience, we went through this, I guess with SARS and flu in about 2003, something like that, where there was a big scare. I think what every company has done in the industry, independent of being invited to the White House to discuss this, although I think that probably helped focus people as well. I think every boardroom said, okay, what do we do? What can we do in this area? Now, not every company works in anti-infectors or vaccines or antivirals, but all the ones that did basically sat down and said, what can we do? What do we bring to the table? How can we contribute? And then decided to say, okay, we're going to focus on this and we're going to take whatever expertise we have and try and move this forward. I think the industry's done a marvelous job in very rapidly taking groups of researchers and focusing on something that they hadn't even heard about the month before. The other interesting thing that the industry is doing is they're basically saying, both from the therapeutic side, like Gilead has done, and on the vaccine side, like J&J is doing, is basically saying, we're not in this to make a profit. We will basically, anything we come up with, we will sell at the cost of that we've had to do to make this stuff. Gilead has gone as far to say that they will provide 1.5 million courses of treatment if their drug works by September or October, I guess. So that's really remarkable and unheard of in the industry. So the industry is really, look, this affects everybody. It affects companies. It affects people in companies. Pfizer's headquarters is in New York City, in the probably the biggest outbreak in the world of this disease. They certainly want to make sure they can come up with things to help that colleagues, families, and friends and stuff like that. And it's really been heartening to see how much people have gotten together to do this.
I see. So would you say that, like, in general, there's a greater financial impetus when they do hear of these newsworthy illnesses or viruses than...
There's no impetus. There's no financial impetus at all for these companies. They're not going to make any money. If they can break even, they'll be lucky, considering how much. And furthermore, they're diverting resources from other things that could perhaps treat certain forms of cancer or diabetes or even Alzheimer's disease. Resources getting diverted from things like that. So no, this is, and I'm biased, right? I spent 30 years in Pfizer, and I've spent the last 12 years in biotech industry, and it's been remarkable to see how they're showing the real value they make to society, despite the bad reputation they unjustifiably have, in my view. They're showing the real value of helping. Because when all this breaks, who do people turn to? They don't turn to Harvard or Boston College or the National Institutes of Health. They turn to, what are the pharmaceutical companies doing? What are the biotech companies doing to save us here? It's a very remarkable response.
I see. Kind of, I guess, on just piggybacking off of that last question, do you think that when the vaccine comes out, the average person, I know you mentioned that they're going to make it so that people will be able to afford it, but do you think that's because of government intervention, especially will the United States have to pay for, you know, vaccines that are handed out in different countries that aren't, you know?
So first of all, the real issue here is access, it's insurance. So for all of those people who have insurance, my guess would be that the government, because my flu shot is free every year. It comes from my insurance company. And I would see the same thing happening here. The bigger issue will come for people who don't have insurance. And I would hope that the government would basically say, okay, you go get your flu shot and the government will pay for access to those who are uninsured. So I think that's where the rogue will come. So I don't think my hope would be nobody would have to pay for it and that it would all come through your normal insurance processes or through the government if you don't have healthcare.
I see.
I think about 15% of the country doesn't have healthcare. So if you lived in Europe or Canada, you'll all get it for free because your country will pay for it. Hopefully in the United States, the same thing will happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about countries like China? Do you think that they will have?
Oh, China will provide it for free, guaranteed.
Any closing remarks?
Well, I think I'll just reinforce some of the messages I've said. Companies have worked closely. And by the way, I should include the NIH and the FDA because they've been intimately involved in providing advice to companies. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the combination of the three that will expeditiously get this vaccine to everyone in the country. So you need to have all that working together. But having said that, it's been remarkable how from, again, just hearing about this virus 8 weeks ago or however long ago it was, to maybe having a vaccine or a therapeutic within months, at least for the therapeutic, and within 12 months, maybe, if J&J is lucky and everything breaks well, is a remarkable testament to the to what can happen in this country when people band together to help everyone for the greater good.
I see. So the second part of this podcast is talking about practical advice you would give to a college student or a young working professional. We're going to start with what is the biggest piece of advice that you would give to someone who's starting their career out?
Well, it's going to be a little bit trite. I would say that you should work in a career that you're excited about. You know, you shouldn't go to law school because your family wants you to go to law school. I have a nephew who graduated from BC last year, and he always wanted to be in pre-med, and he was in the pre-med program at BC, did pretty well. But when he got to his junior year, he really got interested in filmmaking and wanted to do that as a career. And he was really worried about disappointing his parents and his family, and but people were supportive, and now he's at very entry level in film career, although in this current age of COVID-19, most things are shut down. But nevertheless, he's really happy. He's excited about what he's doing. He's really an associate producer on various programs, which associate producer means you're just a glorified gopher. But he's learning, and he's pretty excited. So the first thing I would advise people is to pick something that you really like, that you really enjoy doing. And the next interesting part will be your first job and your first step in your career may not be what you end up doing for the rest of your life. I know people who have gone into, let's stay on the medical school scheme, who were pre-med, got into medical school, got their medical degree, but then did something very different. They decided they were more interested to get involved with small companies and trying to help them raise funds or be part of a venture capital company and decide what kind of healthcare companies were best to invest in. I worked with people at Pfizer who had gotten their PhDs in chemistry and then decided they really wanted to be more involved on the development side. Became involved in clinical trials. I wouldn't, certainly if, like I did, I wanted to be a chemist and I went and was a chemist and did that for a good chunk of my life, that's fine. But to do something that you really enjoy and you get excited about, and then when you're in your career, learn about all the doors that might open to you as part of doing what you're doing at that time.
I see. So what would you say are some of the flaws you see with younger people when they do start out their careers?
Well, certainly I've seen people do something that they probably they did because they were pleasing others. Well, they thought they shouldn't, and they turned out to be a disaster of what they decided to do, and that's not good for anybody. So it comes back to my earlier point. But I think the other thing, if you're going to choose a career, you ought to be good at it, and you ought to work hard at it. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be hired by a company who's hiring you to be a certain expert, albeit a low-level expert. But even a newly minted chemist going into a big company is being hired because they are on the cutting edge of the new science, and the company wants to add that expertise and abilities into their place. And you want to have somebody who's very good at what they're doing. And so being good at it and being an expert as much as you can, be it with a bachelor's degree or a master's or a PhD, is important going forward.
I see. Yeah, well, do you have any personal experiences of when you first started in your career that you think could be pretty useful for young people to hear?
Well, I think certainly there were times I was given tasks to do that had to be done, but it wouldn't have been my first choice. But, you know, the company needed somebody to do it. They asked me to do it. And I found that if I did a really good job at it, it was looked upon very, very favorably, more so because people realized we got to get somebody to do this. Well, it's not going to be a top choice, but let's get so-and-so to do it. And you do it, and they come back and say, wow, this turned out to be pretty good. So I would argue that any assignments you're given, even if it's not your top choice, you ought to perform to the best of your abilities because it'll get noticed.
Yeah, yeah. And then I guess once you start getting noticed and you start rising through the ranks of, a company like Pfizer or just any big corporation, what does it feel like when you get a new role with greater responsibilities? We kind of have mentioned this term, imposter syndrome, where it feels as though, you know, you're quote unquote unqualified for the position you're in and you feel as though people are going to catch you. Did you ever have that experience?
Well, not exactly that, but let me give you a few examples in life. So, you know, you're an undergraduate in college, and, you know, 4 years, by the time you get to be a senior, you feel pretty smart. Whatever your major is, by the time you've gone through 4 years, you know way more about that major than you did when you were a freshman or sophomore. You feel pretty good. And then you either go to a job, you go to graduate school, and you're at the bottom of the totem pole again. And you're around with all sorts of smart people, but you then, you know, learn and go forward and stuff. And then I remember, so I thought I was pretty hot stuff after I got my PhD, and then I did a 2-year postdoc. And then on my first day at Pfizer, I walk in and they hired me because I was a chemist, and I like to think I was a pretty good chemist. And then I'm part of a team where these people know way more than I do, all about drug discovery and development. And I'm in a room with a team, and they're talking about, and I'm worried about just making compounds that have activity. And they're talking about, well, it might be active in a test tube, but is it going to have the right drug metabolism characteristics? Can you make a pill out of it? Will it be stable? Will it be toxic? And I'm like, huh? and so you're learning. Now, one of the great things about this is you're always in an environment where you're learning, and you're learning. And as I went up the ladder, I'd be put in charge of a new group. So suddenly I'm in charge of the cardiovascular group. I know diddly about cardiovascular research or even heart disease. But the challenge is you get in, you learn, you become a bit of an expert in it, and you're always growing. And so I guess if you're in an ideal position or an ideal job, you're always growing in one way or another. And that's what makes it terrific. So I spent 30 years at Pfizer, but I never, and you young people look at me and said, God, you're a dinosaur. I would never go spend 30 years at the same company. But I, every few years, suddenly I had some new responsibilities. Suddenly I was doing something different. Suddenly I had to grow in various ways. And that was pretty stimulating. But I would like to add something else, because particularly if you're in sciences, but I think this might be the same for people who are thinking into a big company or a small company, because in what I do, people now, scientists come out, they have a choice of working either in perhaps a small biotech company, startup company, or a big company. And you should understand your own, psyche or needs and wants. So I always wanted to be in a big company for one reason, for the security aspects of it. When you're in a big company, it's not likely to go bankrupt. in the next year or two. Now, they may have get out of certain therapeutic areas, get into therapeutic areas. So you not every company is immune. Even a big company like Pfizer is immune to eliminating jobs. Well, for the most part, you have a pretty secure life in terms of salary and benefits, et cetera. But you're part of a mission. If you go to a small company, go to a 75-person tech company, you are really important. Now, if you suddenly don't show up to work one day or something, there's a big hole in the company you're in. In a 75-person company, you know everybody. You feel like, and then you've got to be a jack of all trades. You know, you might be trained as a chemist, but you have to run biology studies yourself and some testing studies. Or if the Xerox machine breaks, you've got to fix it or something like that.
Yeah.
So there are different types of environments, and you should understand yourself, big company or small company, as to what you're looking for, what you want to get out of it. But that's something to keep in mind as you go forward.
Yeah. So I guess just the final things I kind of want to ask you about. In short, how did you know chemistry was for you, and how did you know pharmaceuticals was for you?
Oh, so I was a nerdy kind of kid. I had a chemistry set when I was like 10 or 12 years old. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I would just mix things to get different colors or to cause something to precipitate or to maybe even make a little small explosion, I guess. My mother didn't like that. But I would do that sort of stuff. And I always knew I wanted to do something practical. You know, I liked history, but I couldn't see myself being a historian or a career in that area. And so I was drawn to science and chemistry, but I didn't want an academic job. I wanted to do something where, again, it's the practicality aspect of it. I knew I wanted to make molecules that would have biological activity. I thought I was really intrigued in the idea of making a molecule that someday might benefit millions of people. And so that was the big driving force for me. I never actually achieved that, by the way. Nothing I ever made made it to people, but I was able to contribute in other ways. But that was the thing I wanted to do. My kids, interestingly enough, also have known what they wanted to do and have gone into that as well. So they've been blessed. I haven't had anybody in our immediate family who just was lost in college and couldn't, you know, flit around from major to major. So that was fortunate. Yeah. I sympathize with people who go through that, because that has to be hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of people probably listening are somewhere there. But I guess, you know, just kind of to conclude, is there any, you know, just lasting piece of advice you'd want to give to 20-something-year-olds who are entering what could be a recession and, you know, 24 months of biological uncertainty?
I would say that you really own your career, no matter where you are, in college, if you go off to graduate school, if you get off to get a job afterwards, no matter what kind of a job you get, you have to manage your own career. You can't depend on anybody else to do that. Try and learn as much as you can, understand different roles in your company, understand what it takes to get promoted, what's really important. And how to go, and if you want to go in a different direction in your company, try and understand that, build connections with other people that'll help you do that. And no matter, as I said earlier, no matter what assignment you do, do it well, do it so that it gets noticed. And people are going to have a tough time going forward. But I would say this, I think that, if you're involved, I think if you're not involved in the service industry, I think companies will certainly be hiring going forward, because there's still a need to do it. The basic banking system is pretty strong, and there's money there, and that will help move things forward. And companies will be able to borrow money at zero interest rates and be able to expand if need be. So unless you're in hotel management or you want to be a pilot or something, I think going forward, we'll be okay. I hope that's the case.
I see. Well, John, thank you so much for your time and for just being part of this podcast. And thank you for giving a little bit more information about COVID and some pretty helpful advice on entering the business world. Thank you.
Hey, good luck to everybody out there. And even though you're young and not infallible, so be careful.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Or immortal, really. Thank you.